Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. In the past, the Keystone Crossroads Reporting Project, which WPSU is a part of, has looked at the issues facing education in cities. Kevin McCory is the education reporter and the editor of the project. He recently visited northwestern Pennsylvania to report on the issues that rural school districts face. He found schools trying to adapt to changes in the state funding model and dealing with students whose families have been affected by the opioid crisis. Kevin McCory, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Emily.
So we talked with you several months ago about your podcast for Keystone Crossroads called Schooled, where you followed a single mom in a tough part of Philadelphia. She worked to graduate from high school. This time you wanted to focus on rural education. How did you choose Titusville and Corey in northwestern Pennsylvania?
Well, like you said, I'd been doing so much urban education reporting over the past few years for the Keystone Project. And, one of the dynamics that just appears in that is this debate about school funding. And you have this, vigorous debate in Harrisburg about who should get what and how it should be allocated. And you have a lot of advocates in, poorer urban districts who feel like their districts haven't been prioritized, who feel like the state funding, hasn't been as robust to really meet the needs of those kids. And then you have this new school funding formula that comes in, really takes into account all the things that the advocates say should be taken into account. And as that's being ramped up, you see, a clear kind of set of winners and losers. And, it's pretty black and white that the districts that had gained over time through the 1990s into the 2000s and up to just, a few years ago, were a lot of rural districts in parts of Pennsylvania that had seen massive decreases in population, and thus their school population went down. But based on this state policy called Hold Harmless, the state wasn't trimming the money that they give to the districts every year based on the fact that the enrollment was going down. So, in effect, over time, if you had a school district that had 3,000 people in 1991, and now they have 2,000 people, the state was still sending them money as if they had 3,000 people. And with less people, of course, then the per pupil funding amount goes up. And that dynamic right there, many people in the urban centers and the districts that have been growing in population as opposed to declining find, fundamentally unfair. And I just was curious, well, what is life actually like in those districts? Because one of the things you always would hear from lawmakers is, well, if we took that policy away, that hold harmless policy away, it would devastate these districts. And they would say, don't think that they don't have challenges and issues of their own. Don't think they're not dealing with poverty and the effects of all that there as well. And so I thought, well, I should really go and investigate this myself and kind of talk to the people on the ground. And so the first thing I did was, kind of run my spreadsheets of where has enrollment gone down tremendously in the state, what school districts, and see if there were any of those that kind of came to the top of that list that would be willing to talk. And two of many that I had reached out to, welcomed me with open arms, and they happened to be adjacent to each other. So like you said, Corey School District and Titusville. So Titusville is in Crawford County as well as Venango County, and Corey is in Erie, Crawford, and Warren County. So this very rural part of Pennsylvania, and I feel like for people in Philadelphia, in Allentown, even, Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, State College, there's people who just aren't familiar with this part of the state, and I thought it would be worth spending a week up there, and that's what I did, and I talked to a lot of parents and students and administrators and teachers and the like and wrote this story.
And because of this hold harmless, these areas had some of the highest per capita funding from the state, but that's changing now.
Yeah, this new funding formula says, the allocations that come from state government that go to the 500 school districts in Pennsylvania, those allocations will be distributed on this student-based rational system where we're going to say how many kids do you actually have, what's the poverty level, how many kids do you have in charter schools, how many kids do you have that need English language learner support, and a variety of other factors in a very scientific way. And that scientific way was, you know, universally lauded, and it was done in a bipartisan manner. But of course, you know, the districts that had been the beneficiaries of that hold harmless money now have to, over time, adjust to the fact that, you know, what they had gotten used to just isn't going to be there anymore. And, you know, they look at the formula and say, well, yes, in theory, you know, you could call it a fair funding formula. But, you know, for instance, the superintendent in Corey would say, I don't think this formula really gauges the issues that my district has. Doesn't really gauge the fact that the level of the poverty that I have here, the sparsity of the district that I have to serve, which means, you know, running, you know, thousands and thousands of miles on you know, bus routes down rural dirt roads and the like. You know, so there's always this debate in Pennsylvania about fairness in school funding. And again, for a long time, it benefited some of these really rural, you know, sparse districts that had seen population go down. And now, over time, they're starting to feel the pinch in the other direction. So the one thing that the advocates still would say, the advocates for the urban districts especially, would say is, you know, hey, we have this new formula. We should be running all state funding through it. And
but it's
that
just
was
for
not,
the new funding.
Right. That was not the decision that the lawmakers made at the time, really to help strike a balance between the needs of those urban districts and the needs of the rural districts. Again, for lack of better terminology there, it's not all rurals and all urbans, but that dynamic is present in the whole. So what they said is every time we put, you know, a new $100 million into the pot, that money will go through the formula. And then each year, as that number grows and grows, the amount that the formula is used grows in its stature. But still, you have that legacy, you know, $5 billion number that does not get distributed through the formula.
From listening to your stories about rural schools and urban schools, it seems like they actually share some of the same issues: poverty, drugs. Some of the highest rates of opioid overdose have actually been in Pennsylvania's rural counties. How are schools seeing that affect students?
Yeah, I think that it's all a matter of scale, really, to get at your question, right? You see a lot of the same issues in, for instance, you know, the podcast you mentioned at the top of the story about the student in you know, North Philadelphia. You see a lot of that same dynamic happening in some of the more rural parts of the state. But, of course, the scale is just different. In one case, you can look at it and say, well, you know, of course, Philadelphia or Allentowns or some of those urban districts, the concentrations just make the problem so much harder to overcome. But at the same time, I think that I think there's a lot that the two systems could learn from each other. And there's probably a lot of value just in the fact that, you know, a recognition from each that the other has similar problems and similar difficulties. And in the rural sections of the state, you see it definitely affecting students and teachers, less so, especially when you reference the opioid crisis, less so from the actual students, right? I didn't hear that from many people that, you know, this is an issue that we're dealing with current students, but more from their parents, from, you know, very young, the young students, the early childhood kids, the kindergarten kids, elementary school kids, that their parents have been suffering from this, and they see a clear effect on the kids. And then they, you know, can kind of conversely worry about the high school students who are graduating, who, you know, if they don't find an opportunity, either, you know, via college or moving away or staying and finding some sort of stable middle class job, that you know, the drugs are there and they're cheap, and they, you know, they just see far too many people kind of turning towards them and going in that direction. So it's not
right,
the,
and maybe the, their parents can't hold down a job, can't pass a drug test to get a job, and I imagine it's hard to focus on an education in those instances.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's one of the things that's clearly common everywhere, right? If you have parents who are struggling to make ends meet, who are struggling with those larger demons, that absolutely affects your development as a child, and that spills into, you know, how you're able to achieve academically and socially and all the things that, you know, we hope the school system does to prepare kids to be productive citizens and people and workers.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. Our guest is Kevin McCory, the education reporter and editor of the Keystone Crossroads Reporting Project. He recently visited northwestern Pennsylvania to report on the issues facing rural school districts in Pennsylvania. You went with the Titusville police chief, Harold Minch, to a house that had been squatted in by drug addicts. I want to play that and a little portion before that from one of your stories.
You have parents come in when you even talk to them, and you know that they're on something.
That's Diane Robbins, principal of Titusville's pre-K program. Principal Lisa Royak of nearby Hightown Elementary sees it with the parents of young children, too.
I've had times I won't let kids leave with parents because I know. I've only had to ever pursue law enforcement for that once, but they're usually pretty reasonable about it. I'll just say, hey, I don't really think you ought to be driving with Johnny in the car. They're usually like, yeah, put him on the bus. I mean, they know.
This is what Titusville Police Chief Harold Minch calls the dirty little secret of the current drug crisis, the collateral damage being caused on children.
And those children have to be taken care of by somebody, and many times it falls to the grandparents.
Titusville, once a wealthy beacon of the oil industry, has struggled to rebound from deindustrialization. The area is quaint. It's a proud small town surrounded by a gush of natural beauty. And you can walk around at night with little to worry about. The signs of distress and despair are also easy to find.
Not uncommon for us to find needles up here. They, not only heroin, but they melt the pills down and shoot them as well. That's standard all over the country.
What kind of pills are they melting?
Any opiate pill. You know, insert opiate derivative here. And that's what they're doing. That's everywhere.
835.
Show me out at 510 Mailer Street.
During a ride along with Chief Minch, we stop at a house that was squatted in by addicts in an otherwise well-kept neighborhood.
Dumpster, everything in that dumpster was out on the floor and out inside the house.
Inside is a nightmare, a scene of filthy neglect that town workers had spent the morning trying to clear out.
Bad thing is there was a baby in here with them.
I know. Their mama's on probation. That mama's on probation, too. I watched her pee dirty right there in the probation officer's office 2 weeks ago.
One of the workers shows Minch all the needles they found.
Good Lord.
Bags and bags of needles. You know, there's one there,
yep,
there's one there.
Yeah, I didn't expect any different from them.
Yeah.
That's disgusting.
Upstairs in the back bedroom, parts of the roof are exposed and the ceiling has molded over.
And this is not uncommon that there would be a place in disrepair?
This is pretty bad right here.
Okay.
Yeah, this is fairly spectacular. This might be one of the worst I've ever seen. I mean, that'll kill you.
I mean, I am a little surprised that a community would welcome you in and show you, you know, this pretty dark look there.
And I think that is probably related to the personality, really, and the character of that police chief. I mean, he is he's a new resident in Titusville. He had come from Naples, Florida, where he was the head of a much larger force, obviously a much larger city, 500,000 or so people in Naples, Florida, compared to, you know, a few thousand in Titusville. He had, you know, come to Titusville recently to be the chief of this town, and he has this confidence that, you know, this is something that he can take care of. And he has, you know, worked actively to address the issue. He has the kind of consensus of the leaders in the area that are kind of all on the same page and what they need to do here. This is certainly something that comes up in conversation. This is on a lot of people's minds, and it's clearly an issue that's plaguing them. But at the same time, it is a beautiful area. There is a lot of pride in you know, what that town and that area is and was and can be. And I don't think that they're afraid of the problems that they have. And I think that they think that by talking about them and being open and especially putting an emphasis on what the school district can do as a hub of support for the community is a good thing.
And of course, they're not alone. I mean, this is an issue throughout Pennsylvania in many communities, especially these areas that are struggling with the loss of industry. How have these high schools or schools in the areas adapted to the new or relatively new economy that these kids will be graduating into, trying to prepare them for that?
Well, one of the interesting things that I found when I went there is the elementary school system has embraced this new pilot model for kind of a different type of education that really is in direct reaction to what they've seen as this decline of industry. And so in this one elementary school, Hightown Elementary, the school staff really bolstered the idea that they needed to radically rethink what an education was. And the principal there, who we heard a little bit in that last clip, Lisa Royek, you know, said to me, like, look, the industrial model of education isn't going to work anymore. We really need to get out of this idea that, you know, kids come to a classroom, sit in rows and take orders from the teacher, and, you know, the teachers cover the content in the textbook and move on. You know, that's an idea that many people in education have talked about moving away from. And I think in Titusville specifically, they've seen with industry going away, they've seen maybe more starkly how that model doesn't apply so much anymore to the modern workforce and the modern world. And so what they did is they said, we're not going to organize students by age anymore, by grade anymore. We're going to say, you know, where are you on a skill continuum? And we're going to focus on meeting you where you are and then helping you get better at skills, helping you master abilities as opposed to quote unquote covering content. And that takes a huge leap for educators, too, to kind of get their heads around and say, you know, this isn't just, you know, I covered the chapter in the book and now we have a quiz and a test and we move on. This is saying it's important for my students to have certain abilities, to master certain skills, and we stay with them and work with them until that happens. And so you might have, you know, a kid who typically would be a second grader, but maybe this is a hypothetical, right? Maybe they're a little bit behind, quote unquote, in English, and they're a little ahead, quote unquote, in math. And so, you know, they're grouped by their abilities, and maybe they're with, you know, third graders, quote unquote, some of the day, and first graders, quote unquote, the other part of the day. And it to, what that means to them is that they're keeping kids engaged in school. They're meeting them where they are. They're always challenging them, but they're never overwhelming them. But, you know, this is only the second full year that they've implemented this. And, you know, as you can imagine, it's a pretty radical shift in how you think about school.
And so far, you know, at least standardized test-wise, the results haven't been great.
They haven't, right. Through 1 year of testing, they went down in the number of students who were considered advanced or proficient, and they went up in the number of students who would be considered below basic, which would be the lowest protocol. Now, the superintendent of the district would say, well, that's true, but we also have to acknowledge that that was actually true at all of our schools. So not just the one that we implemented this model, this new model into. And also she would say, you know, this is a method of education that really prizes creativity, collaboration, grit, things that they say don't really show up as much on the standardized test scores.
And this is pretty innovative. This isn't something that's being done many places.
Right. It's certainly not ubiquitous in across Pennsylvania, but there are districts who are doing it, and there is a consortium in the Mid-Atlantic states that really pushes this. And this idea is, they call it mass customized learning. Each child has an education plan customized for themselves. Hence, mass customized. They've got other stories across the state where this is being implemented to some degree or another. But when you talk to their executive director, he will say Titusville is one of the most, if not the most, robust school in how this is being implemented. And the way he would put it is, you know, they are just radically learner-centered. He would characterize the way we typically think about school as teacher-centered. It's about the teacher covering content.
And one of the people in your story said that the hope is that students will be more ready for the jobs of tomorrow and that they hope maybe they'll stay in the area. How do they hope that this will create more jobs locally?
Well, one of the things that they have already taken as a sign of encouragement is, despite the fact that population has clearly trended downward over the past few decades, anecdotally, they're starting to see some of their, let's call them their best and brightest high school graduates of some years past, coming back to town because they love living in the area and they love the beauty of the area, coming back to town and being able to work remotely. So they take that as a very encouraging sign to say, you know, if the jobs of tomorrow are all about, you know, being able to connect with people via technology, being able to work at your own pace, and all the things that go into, you know, working remotely, then maybe we have a chance to give our kids a head start on those sorts of skills by emphasizing something like this mass customized model, which really says, again, this is about collaboration. This is about your own kind of personal ingenuity, your ability to work with technology and work with a group using technology. You know, they extrapolate that and say, well, hey, 10, 20 years from now, maybe there will just be more jobs like that in general. And why not Titusville? Why wouldn't people choose to live in this area if they're, you know, they're not dependent on moving to Erie or Pittsburgh or Harrisburg to get a job?
Yeah, and you went to Titusville during homecoming. You've got the pep rally, the cheering fans. The idea seems to be that in addition to being places for education, these schools are hubs for the communities that they're in. You know, the whole town's at the homecoming game.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something that I think a lot of people in education kind of idealize, this idea of the neighborhood school, right? And in cities, we often talk about the neighborhood school as being the hub of that neighborhood. I think it's probably an even starker dynamic when you go to a small town where literally, you know, the school's in the center of the town, and a lot of what binds people to that area is the school, and that's their commonality, and that's where you're going to find kind of resources of support, not just for students, but also for, you know, people who are struggling, you know, post-graduation or didn't graduate and are trying to, you know, get their GED, but then also just socially, right? Like you referenced the football games, just, you know, the whole culture of the area is to some degree predicated on this commonality, and the school system plays a big part in that.
And one of the schools that you went to, you talked about the facilities, and they were quite impressive, especially the Votech facilities. You talked about auto shop, hydroponic gardening, nursing, daycare, multimedia production. Perhaps this is where Hold Harmless actually helped this area and these schools. You know, do they worry that that's going to change now with the fair funding formula?
They do. That's the Corey High School that you referenced. And, you know, the superintendent and the staff there would say exactly that. They say, look, you know, the facilities that we have right now are very impressive. And we think that they're very important because in this area, there is a lot of poverty. And we have seen, again, the deindustrialization up close. And, you know, for a lot of students, the ability to connect with something more, you know, tactile in their education, like you said, automotive, hydroponic gardening, daycare is, you know, kind of essential to their learning experience. And that's going to be the most direct way that they're going to prepare themselves for really viable jobs in the community. And now they're finding it harder and harder to financially support all the things that go into that. So, you know, if you're welding, you know, you need all the supplies, all those things that they would call consumables, right? The things that just, you know, take money to use and to do in classrooms, they see the belt tightening already starting. And as they look down the road and they think, well, you know, this formula doesn't prioritize us as much as the old way of state funding used to go, we're going to have to start making some tough decisions, right? And so that's either, are you going to cut programs? Are you going to, cut staff? And they've already started doing some of those things. Or are you going to
maybe like with raising property taxes,
right?
Is that, I don't know if that would be a viable option in that area.
Right. So that's the other thing that they have to kind of debate between, because on the one hand, they don't want to sacrifice the program. On the other hand, they look and say, we want to make our region more viable and more attractive for people to move into. And if we have to raise property taxes to fund these programs, then that makes us maybe a little less competitive as a place to live than compared to the district across the county or whatever it may be, right? So that's a real tough prospect. I mean, that prospect of rising property taxes is not just a story in Cory, right? That's a story across Pennsylvania. As you've seen pension mandates, healthcare mandates, you've had a lot more pressure on local taxpayers, and that puts, you know, sometimes the school and the community at odds, right? That's the other part of the school being a hub of the community. That's one way to look at it. And sometimes people in the community think, well, the school is sucking the resources that are needed. And there's this debate between, you know, how much support do we give the school to ensure the future generations are all the more prepared, or how much do we, you know, protect our financial interest in the here and now?
You could probably get both communities, the rural and the urban, to agree. You know, they'd probably both like more funding from the state.
Absolutely. And that's where you have your kind of top flight advocates on this issue in Harrisburg. They've never really made a big deal about hold harmless, I think, because they know that at the end of the day, a lot of those districts that were benefiting from that are struggling and are poor and have a lot of the same issues that the urban ones have. So then they turn around and say, well, yeah, the answer is we just need to provide a bigger total at the state level to help support those districts, right? But then that gets into the debate about, well, where are you going to get the money to mm-hmm. do that? And at the levels that the advocates had been asking, I mean, it would be a serious tax increase, either a sales tax increase or a personal income tax increase. And you've seen Governor Wolf attempt to advocate for those taxes himself, and that's gone nowhere through three budget cycles now, coming into his fourth as a governor. And so, you know, the middle way has been, you know, more incremental yet steady increases to the education line in Harrisburg. That satisfied some people, but it's certainly not the big number that the advocates say is really needed to give the rurals and the urbans everything that they need.
So either in education or other areas, what project can we look for next from Keystone Crossroads?
Well, Keystone Crossroads is continually covering the two trials related to redistricting efforts in Pennsylvania. So you have a trial at the federal level and at the state level alleging that the congressional map was gerrymandered, and, you know, in both cases trying to have them thrown out as unconstitutional. So we've been covering that pretty robustly. You referenced the podcast Schooled at the top of the show. I'm currently in the works of writing season two of that, so another three episodes of that. And in addition, you know, more stories that we hope are kind of filling in the gaps for the kind of the reporting gaps in Pennsylvania, right? So we're not so parochial. It's not just what's the paper in State College say and what's the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette say and, you know, the Philadelphia Daily News. But how can we tell the stories that really connect all Pennsylvanians and highlight, you know, the problems but also possible solutions?
Kevin McCory, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Emily.
Kevin McCory is the education reporter and the editor of the Keystone Crossroads Reporting Project. WPSU is also part of the project. You can find this series on rural education and other stories from Keystone Crossroads at keystonecrossroads.org. I'm Emily Reddy, WPSU.